G'day humans, this is Uncomfortable Conversations. Welcome to The Buzz, which is technically a panel chat show about science and tech-related news, but which actually uses nerd headlines to discuss bigger questions of life, the universe, and everything. My co-chatterers today are Joel Pearson and Rad Yo. Joel, you're an inveterate frequent guest this week. just by accident that you're on twice.
I can't stop coming.
Yeah. We're not actually... more skeptical people will think that we're recording this on the same day and being lazy. But there's actually a two-month gap between your last
appearance. And I
changed
my T-shirt from white to black, if my memory serves
me right.
If
you can't see Joel's T-shirt, you have to come to YouTube instead of listening to the podcast, and you'll see Joel's beautiful face and also the beautiful face of Rad. Hello, Rad.
Hello.
Do you want to introduce yourself? Maybe? You can plug it. You can plug things at the end. Not now. You can plug things whenever you want to.
My name's Rad. I'm a technology journalist and media presenter over everything and everywhere, and I just really love nerdy stuff.
Rad knows everything about everything. Except for probably cooking. Do you cook?
No, I do cook. I'm actually a really good cook.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there anything, what's the field in which you're least informed?
Let's start there.
What's the maths?
I'm actually quite bad at maths.
Call yourself a nerd.
Well, I don't think
maybe you don't.
I don't think that maths is necessarily a key component of being a nerd. I think that there's multiple disciplines that, you know.
Well, not with AI now, right? You don't need to know math. You don't need to program. You don't need to do any of that anymore.
Yeah. It's true.
And also, like, even if you look at some of the mathier sciences, like physics, a lot of it's also conceptual. So while I may not be able to do the calculations per se, I can still understand and talk about the concepts.
You're sounding like those people who wear T-shirts that say, imagination is more important than knowledge, Einstein.
It's true, Josh.
It's like the fact that Einstein once said that is now the bane of his heritage because idiots use it as an excuse to not know things.
And who's the bigger idiot, the idiot or the idiot that asked the idiot to come to the show?
That's a very good point. The first human has received a brain implant from Elon Musk's Neuralink company this week. I love this. I mean, are we getting to the point at which you can sort of just test on people the way you can test on rockets, and if you blow their brains up, then that's just part of the learning process. What do we make of this? Is the future going to involve human brain interfaces, and is this brilliant or loopy on the part of Mr. Musk? Rad, in fact, do you want to explain what Neuralink is? Do you know what Neuralink is?
Yes. So Neuralink is a brain-computer interface, which essentially means they put implants into the brain. It has hardware that reads messages or, you know, your neurons firing. It interprets those messages, and then theoretically it will control something. So,
and where's the hardware? Is it in your head, or do you have to wheel around a little trolley with a computer on it? With a Commodore 64?
It actually depends on who's giving you the implant. So with Neuralink, they currently have a little cable that comes out of your skull, out of your head.
Seriously?
Which feels a bit... I don't like a cable, but
it's wireless, though, isn't it? It's like a little magnet thing that... Like the cochlear, isn't it?
There are wireless ones. There was a university in China which has just announced the first like wireless one that's gone really well, which was implanted, I believe, in October last year. But I believe Neuralink actually has a cable. You can double check that if you want.
But the cable plugs into what?
Other hardware that's required to run it.
The battery pack, I think. The battery pack sits on the outside.
And so the idea, like I've heard that the part of the idea is that like one day Parkinson's patients could, you know, have be cured because you could be what? Sending a computer program into a part of their brain? I don't quite get it.
That's slightly different, I believe. I believe ones that deal with Parkinson's often are trying to stimulate a part of the brain. I'm not, you might know
that's,
more how
that's deep brain stimulation, substantia nigra, yeah. Mm. Where's the dopamine?
I guess we should have gone to the neuroscientist. You and I are like, let's talk about brains. Shut up, Joel. You're only a neuroscientist.
So that's a different thing, yeah. And that is very promising, and people can have stimulation there, and they'll go from doing this to dead still.
Listeners can't see you, but you're waving your arm and then
YouTube
stopping
people, I'm shaking and then I'm doing a
okay. So, but and then Neuralink is what exactly?
So it's there to control devices. So think people that have had accidents that like mean. So think people that have had like spinal cord injuries, for example, and they can't move their limbs. It's that kind of thing. It allows them to, for example, the when I was talking about with the Chinese university, it allowed a stroke, spinal cord injury victim to move an air-powered glove that allowed him to like pick up things and drink water.
I don't think we call them victims these days, Rad. They're people living with spinal differences, not necessarily victims. But can't you do that using the spinal cord and using the neurology of the person? Why does it need to come out of the person? And
so it depends. So eventually, like the way Elon Musk talks about this, right, we're going to be controlling our computers, our whatever, our phones, we're going to be just you and me, it's going to be telepathy interacting, boom, boom, boom. I think the new device is called telepathy, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
That's the name they gave. So that's what that's the way they talk about it. And that's like Horizon stuff. That's nowhere near there. And so Neuralink's not really even leading the field in this. So other universities mainly, not companies, which is a big difference. So I think Stanford has done it, maybe in Germany they've done it. So yet last year, there's a Stanford study came out where someone had an implant and she could, they trained it on her intentions. She couldn't speak, on her intentions to speak, and it would decode that. So it is using an AI-based algorithm.
If she can't speak, how do they know they've got it right?
Well, she's
like, I want to see a picture.
They train her on looking at words and things, and they get it so it does work. And I think it was like 60 words a minute or something like that to the speed. So
really?
Yeah, so it works.
So you can type.
This thing can work, yeah.
Just using your brain already.
Yes. I mean, but the thing, you can do that with an EEG cap, basically, right?
Not 60 words a minute, surely.
I don't know, but that's the electrodes just sitting on your. With gel on your hair, right?
Yeah. I thought you could think like yes, no.
It's getting
like
pretty
forward, back.
It's getting,
but you can't think like
no. The studies,
man climbed
like
the
Facebook,
Eiffel Tower
Meta's
and
working
jumped
on
off
this.
On a paraglider through an ECG cap. Can you?
Wait, what? Say that again.
You can't think a complicated sentence.
All I heard
like,
was paragliding.
Yeah, you can't think a complicated sentence and have that translated by just wearing a cap with some gel, can you?
I don't. You can with fMRI now, more or less. It catches the gist of what you're saying, not necessarily word for word. So they've done that with fMRI. That was published last year. Then actually scientists at Meta, who work for Meta, did the similar thing with MEG or EEG, I can't remember. But it's not word for word. It gets the gist of the sentence you
want
to say.
Yeah.
Right? But it's you don't have to drill a thing into your skull, right? You're not drilling bone and putting a thing, right? Little needles into your cortex. So it's very different in terms of invasiveness.
Right, but I'm sure it's different in terms of accuracy, surely. I mean, if you've got a little needle that's identifying precise electrical signals between neurons, that's going to be better than just something
but it's really local. It's like a little thing like this, right? If I put EEG, I can get frontal, I can get visual core, I can get the whole, not the brain, but the whole skull coverage, yeah. Right? You can't put a thing in, you will one day, but at the moment you can't open up a whole skull and put like a sticker over the whole brain with little pins and needles.
So where are they
that.
Sticking these things in Neuralink, do you know? Is there a part of the brain responsible for language or something?
It depends whether they're trying to do language or motor. So it depends on the individual patient. So it'll be the motor cortex if they want to get movement, do an arm or leg. So that was done in a patient in Europe last year.
What?
Over the motor cortex. And I think he could walk. So they decoded the wanting to walk signals and that translated to a motor pack here and his legs could
his artificial
sort of
limbs would just start to walk.
No, his real legs, but
his
it was like an exoskeleton kind of situation. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how is that different from just being able to walk with artificial limbs?
The degree of control and the fact that like the device doesn't, you know, it lasts a lifetime. It's implanted in a way that is less likely to break down. So one real big problem that has existed with prosthetic limbs for a long time is the degree of control. They tend to be really just gross motor skills. You can't do a lot of fine movements with them. And a lot of that is owing to the kind of control systems that are used there. If you imagine a like really low resolution screen, right, with really big pixels and you can't see the fine details, it's the same kind of thing. So by being able to plug in directly, so to speak, you're getting a lot more kind of nuance and detail in the signals that are being sent and therefore in fine motor skills.
Got it. So like a person who's lost their hand could be able to delicately thread a needle or something like that using an
Exactly.
An artificial limb.
Rather than your more classic artificial limbs that currently exist, where they might be lucky to be able to pinch the thumb to the four fingers and pick something up.
Right, without crushing it.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, they can bop someone on the head and that's about it. So is this, so the vision of Neuralink, when you hear Elon Musk talk about it in his more whimsical modes, is that someday, well, this is not just going to be for fixing like brain problems or people who've lost limbs or have spinal injuries. This is going to be the way that all of us enhance our cognitive capabilities by expanding our minds into computers in some way. Does that make any sense?
Elon is a creature of novelty and ego, would be my statement on that. He is someone who, I mean, for better or worse, love him or hate him, he does love to dream big. And I think that historically we have seen a really mixed bag of whether or not that dreaming has resulted in the kinds of results that he has promised or wanted, right? So I think Neuralink...
But isn't that just a matter of time, sort of? Isn't like the visionary is sometimes... He dreams up self-driving cars and he says they're always 1 year away. But I think there will clearly be self-driving cars someday. He talks about going to Mars. You know, maybe it's not going to happen as quickly as he wants to. But if humanity survives, we'll probably do it.
But I mean, those predictions are kind of like saying, you know, computers and mechanized systems will continue to enhance our lives. Like, we know that already. That's not surprising. That's not new. So saying we're going to have self-driving cars, I don't think that that's like a peek into the future. That's, if anything, a pretty logical, you know, claim. Same with Neuralink saying we're going to have systems that are able to enhance ourselves. I think that's a pretty logical claim. And I think that there's a really legitimate space where this kind of technology is being worked on, which is this disability and regaining motor function space. And then there is the pie in the sky space that he's talking about. But if BCIs become, you know,
what's a BCI?
A brain computer interface. These little devices we're talking about. If they become commercially viable, they start getting implanted in people, he could say, oh, yes, look, you know, I was correct. Neuralink, it works. And people are using it because it does have a function and it probably will become, you know, usable sometime in the future.
For what? What would a person who doesn't live with a disability use it for?
I don't think it'll come to that space anytime soon, because you need to remember these are deeply invasive kind of devices.
Right, but look at what some people do to themselves with cosmetic surgery, or like, you know, turning into looking like a Korean pop star or something.
Would you do it though?
Well, no,
you
but
can
I don't
control
get
your phone and you can check your X feed. You have to do a massive surgery.
Yeah, it's massive surgery. It's cost. It's the fact that Neuralink at the moment, I believe, doesn't have a wireless kind of charging system. They also implant deeper into the brain, which means that cells can grow over it and that needs to be replaced or updated. There are different
systems. But these are very, very early days. I feel like we're at the dawn of like the automobile and we're saying like, would you get in a car? Well, no, I wouldn't if it's like 1885.
Are you talking in the next 5 years or are you talking 200 years?
Exactly. I mean, yes, I would. If the question is, if there was a safe, affordable, well-proven way of enhancing my ability to understand concepts and for me to think much bigger than I currently do and glimpse visions of reality that heretofore have only been available to me when I'm on acid, then yeah, sign me up.
Well, interestingly, there was a 2019 study that showed that while these interfaces can positively increase a sense of the self and control, they also can induce radical distress, feelings of loss of control, and a rupture of patient identity.
I won't get that one.
Well, it just,
I'll get
it
the good
happens
one,
because
thanks.
Apparently it starts to blur your understanding and bounds of body ownership, self-image, self-understanding between.
Sounds like the dissolution of the ego, baby.
Yeah,
come on, drink the ayahuasca. Let's go. I'm in. Joel, so you were doing this.
I mean, that's one of the things that I was amazed with. So, you know, the locked-in syndrome where you can't communicate or you can just move your eyes. There's different versions, sort of degrees of that. And when people have
like, you mean patients who are completely paralyzed?
Well, they can communicate with their eyes, like the person they did that. So for the first 3 to 6 months, those people have, you know, trauma and they show depression. But after that, they actually bounce back and show pretty normal. You give them sort of questionnaires that you can get them to respond to. They don't seem upset. They don't seem depressed anymore. And so the years following that, they seem to be quite happy. All the indications we have that is that they're happy. when we think about it changing from the life we live to a life like that, it seems horrific and horrible, right? But it seems that's not the case for people living like that, which is an interesting way to try and think about it.
But what does that have to do with a brain-computer interface? You're saying we shouldn't do it because we could get used to being paralyzed?
Well, like Raja said, if they're living a good life and they're enjoying themselves and this thing is invasive.
Just because humans are resilient and we get used to shitty circumstances doesn't mean we shouldn't avoid.
They would deal with it psychologically, right? There are examples of individuals who've had eye surgery or genetic things done to their eyes and gotten sight back in their 30s, right? And hate it. Prefer that they go blindfold because they don't like all the light and all the stimulation.
Well, that's fine. They can have the blindfold. The people who want to see get to see.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm not against developing the tech or using it, but there are psychological dimensions to this that we don't know about at all.
Right. And I think it's maybe an issue of it sounds really cool, but maybe we're fixing a problem that doesn't exist and it may just not be all it's cracked up to be. That being said, develop the tech. I'm all for developing the tech. I think that it's exciting, but I'm not sure that it is the fun thing that it always sounds.
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you're sort of a utopian futurist, doesn't it? Because if you're kind of content with the way that humanity is, then why do we need to, who wants this stuff? But if you're the kind of person like Elon Musk who wants to become an interplanetary species and have brains the size of a universe, then you do think to make that happen.
I don't agree because I think that there are already things that augment our lives that also aren't invasive.
Right, but we wouldn't have developed those things if it weren't for people who had the mindset of Elon Musk, like Steve Jobs, for example, who was responsible for the biggest expansion of our brain capacities that we currently live with, which is the iPhone.
Do you not see a delineation between a device that you utilize and something that changes the self?
Of course I do, and people prior to the invention of the smartphone would have seen a delineation between tech prior to that and this device, or, the same with the automobile or whatever. I have the biases of this particular, time and place that I live in. In the future, if this happens and becomes normalized, then people won't see that clear delineation.
I mean, one of the things we talked about in the last pod we did was how, so the human brain has one thing to focus at. We're typically aware of a very narrow thing and we're only focusing, I can focus on you, and we can't multitask, right? And computers, AI, not like that. They can multitask up, to the million. They can do multiple things simultaneously. And the way Elon talks about, we'll be able to just, this is the only way we can combat AI, to put it, add up to humans, right? So we can expand the number of things we do simultaneously. But that's just not how the human brain or any sort of biological system really works, right? And it's an issue with the Apple Vision Pro, right? This idea, we're just terrible at multitasking. We have think of it like a spotlight on a stage. That's how the brain works. Mm. We can focus on one thing at a time. It feels like we can focus on more than one thing, but we can't. It's really
I am keenly aware of this limitation.
While you're driving, I am terrible. Driving drunk, right? The data shows that very clearly. And so all these people walking around with the headset, the Apple headset, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
It's, they're going to get hit by cars and stuff, right?
We will get to that in a second. But so let me just then drill into, pardon the pun, Neuralink drilling into your brain.
Let's drill into our brains. Yeah.
So what if it was possible for a brain-computer interface to not be used to enhance the number of things that you can do and to facilitate multitasking, but to give you a greater capacity for deep work and creativity by just the way that you might insert more RAM into a computer just to give it more processing power. Is it conceivable that you could augment my, there are some things that I just know that I can't know, but I guess so. But when you start to talk about the size of the universe, it gets to a point at which you notice the limitations of the processing power of your own mind computer. Yeah. You just get to the point where you go, I've lost the thread about the scales that we're talking about here.
I've just decided that I don't like this because it then becomes the rich get richer.
This is my main concern. Mm. Yes, is an egalitarian one. Does it become
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You'll have the people that can afford the best, enhancements, and you'll have those that...
Yeah, does it become an accelerant of inequality? Although I did hear, I think it was Mark Andreessen who was saying that, we do fear that tech is going to create that more of the haves and have-nots, but actually there's no greater democratizer than the smartphone, which if you think about an era of kings and, you know, feudal societies and stuff, there were things that the king had that nobody else had. And there were things that aristocrats lived with that the poor never did. And actually today there is, although there's vast economic inequality, the actual, the tools that are, that most change our lives are largely available to everybody. Smartphones, sanitation, whatever it might be.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, but I am not sure that I think a brain-computer interface is on par with a smartphone, because I don't think there's the same level of kind of trickle-down or used devices that would be able to be passed on, which is one way that people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds would be able to obtain.
I mean, it depends whether it becomes as simple as a cataract operation or
any kind of operation still continues to be pretty expensive.
Well, maybe it'll be something that you can just plug into your head at home. You can put in through, you can feed in through your ear. I mean, we just don't know. But I do think that it's hard when you're on the precipice of a new technology to feel like it could be normal. And I do think that if 20 years ago or 25 years ago, someone had said to you, it's going to be completely normalized, that you'll walk around with a supercomputer in your pocket, constantly being bothered by what random people on the other side of the world are saying about something. Young people are going to spend all of their time communicating with each other, even people they've never met, on the supercomputer, like that, you would be like, that's not going to be normal. I don't think that's going to be widespread. Like, that might be something that some people will want to do, but not everybody's going to do that.
I think I could see that being normal. I think the difference here really is the surgery augmentation element of it. And I think it's very, very different to use something that's outside of yourself versus bring something into yourself. I'm not saying that I don't think it's going to become widespread, because I think once people start doing it, it's an advantage, if it is an advantage, and more people will want it. And it's that slow movement towards. But at the same time, I think we continue to have conversations about tech to the tune of, just because we should, does that mean that we, just because we can, does that mean that we should? And I think that is more where this conversation sits, perhaps.
And lastly, Joel, how feasible is it that, like, the sort of utopian use cases for brain computing interfaces will actually work? Like, I don't understand enough about how close the analogy is between the way that computers process information and the way that the human brain processes information to understand how complicated it would actually be to, for me to go into surgery, and then when I come out, I'm like, oh, I completely understand, you know, something that I wasn't able to understand before. Like, is that feasible, or is that pie in the sky?
There's both scientific and engineering challenges there, right? So using fMRI, brain scans, or chip in or electrodes into the tissue and training a thing to decode the letters and you know, some rough sentences is very different to feeling the stream of the stock market or something like that, right? There's major scientific hurdles to get through in decoding. We don't really understand the way the brain works, what the neural language of thought is yet. And so it's not just engineering and making things smaller, you know, shinier and better and faster. It is figuring out that language. So both those things have to happen really before we get to that utopian, you know, telepathy thing with AI.
Right. And what about memory capacity? Like, just if there's an analogy to RAM that I made, then there could also be an analogy to storage. Yes. Like, could you put something in my brain now that would give me a greater, maybe not for past memories, but for future memories, that would give me a greater capability of storing?
We don't understand where an n-gram of a memory is, right? It's distributed, the hippocampus, the different areas are very important, but we don't really understand how a memory is stored and distributed in the brain yet. And so without knowing that, you can't. The best way to do it is to give chemicals and molecules to the brain or stimulate it electrically. And you can do things like that and improve those things. But plugging in things, we don't know where to plug and what to do yet.
I mean, surely it would just come down to further augmentation, and it would record video and audio at all times that it would store somewhere that you would then be able to recall through some sort of search using AI that tells you everything that's in that image.
Right. Yeah. So it doesn't actually have to directly be stored. No. Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't experience it like a memory.
Yeah, I don't think that these devices are going to go in the way of just making you superhuman and enhancing your biology. I think it will give you the ability to use devices that enhance what you do. So in that way, instead of, you know, making it so that your memory lasts forever, it records things for you that you can then recall in an easier way.
This is the perfect segue into the other thing that I wanted to talk about that's in the news this week, which is the Apple Vision Pro. It's been all over the place. This is Apple's new virtual reality headset. It's their first attempt to get into this game. We had the Google Glass glasses, probably a decade ago now.
At least
and Facebook
more,
yeah. has been playing around with its Oculus for some time. These are mostly used by gamers, but you know, we're sort of waiting for the killer virtual reality piece of hardware that's going to change the way that we interact with computers. Is this a lame corporate attempt to sell us on a phony future? Will virtual reality ever go mainstream? How will we interact with computers in the long term? What do you make of it, Rad?
Well, I can say for damn sure it's at least better than Meta's little metaverse moment. Which
have you used an Oculus or one of these?
Very early ones. Uh-huh. I've used like early Oculus and Vive, and I've used PSVR. I haven't used the Vision Pro.
Is PSVR a PlayStation product?
Yes, okay. It's a PlayStation. It's a gaming only, basically, VR thing, yeah.
And what did you make of it? Was it transcendent? Some people are like, oh my goodness, this is like a different universe. And some people are like, it just makes you look too uncool.
Well, it's very strange because you start to realize how much you believe what you see. So again, I've done this primarily in gaming contexts, and I've done ones where you're sitting in a chair and using a controller and doing whatever. And those are interesting, but they don't really sell it. But the ones that totally get you are when you're moving your body in a space with the headset on. And that's this really strange experience of knowing, for example, that you're not walking across a bridge with, you know, a 100-story drop beneath you. You're walking in a warehouse on a flat floor. But because you can see it, you believe it. You know you're not walking up a wall, but because the camera moves like you are, you fully believe it. And it's this out-of-body experience that I think the Vision Pro has the chance of kind of enhancing upon, because it's not looking to just bring those kind of wacky moments. It's looking to integrate into your everyday life.
What's the pitch? What's that integration into your everyday life pitch?
I think it's multitasking, quite honestly. Being able to
spatial computing, because it's spatial, to say the word.
Yeah, I've seen one of the videos that went viral on social media about the Apple Vision Pro was a dude on the subway in New York who's typing on an imaginary keyboard, and he's just sitting there. I mean, these
pretty funny videos.
Like, please. I remember with Google Glass as well, all these like loser incel, you know, kids who can't get a boyfriend or a girlfriend are just wandering around the streets wearing these daggy things on their face.
I'm those kids.
Annihilating any chance of ever getting any romantic love or affection from this universe. And now they're sitting on a crowded subway, tap, tap, tapping into the air and swipe, swipe, swiping.
I think it's
Minority Report style. You should all get a room together somewhere. Yeah. I mean, really. So the idea is that, I mean, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the idea that there's going to be a revolution in the way that we interact with computers, right? It's unlikely that my kids, when they're my age, surely, are going to be sitting down in front of a physical, like, laptop or, like, a physical... Rad is raising her eyes like you think it is. Do you think they're going to be typing on buttons in 40 years?
I
reckon they will be.
40 years? No.
Aren't they just going to be thinking and swiping and talking?
Two things. One, I do think that keyboards are going to be a bit of a harder sell because the generations below are just touchscreen obsessed, touchscreen natives.
Right, but the touchscreen has a keyboard on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like everything we still do is still filtered through, well, I suppose speech to text is getting better, but you're still correcting things using the idea of letters on.
But speech to text also requires you to say it out loud, which also means that other people can hear you, whereas a keyboard.
The tech dude bros on the subway won't give a shit. They'll just be like, Siri, Sal.
But there are ways around that, right? You can have the thing that, like in the spy films, they have the little microphone thing. You can have bone conductance and microphones here.
But you're still having to create the noise.
But very, very quiet. I mean, there are ways around that. But yeah, it is.
Imagine looking up a spicy video.
But the visual, the Apple Pro thing has that. Their speakers are outwards facing.
They're not outwards facing.
Well, I mean, they're not, because people go, oh, I want to use this for watching movies on flights, right? But there's nothing covering your ear. There's no noise cancellation.
Oh, really?
There's no, yeah. I mean, that's that.
I'm pretty sure you can just then like pair it with headphones and use that.
I hope so, because yeah, there's no noise cancellation.
But I think that's part of their vision, if you'll excuse the pun, of having it be a device that you can use while still.
That's
the
augmented,
being in the real world, yeah.
I mean, again, coming back to this thing that I just sort of touched on earlier about it's hard to put yourself in the mind of an era when things that we regard as normal weren't normal. But prior to the personal computer, like, apparently the mouse was a real killer app, like a killer invention, mm-hmm. that prior to being able to, to scroll the cursor around and click... Like, that was the thing that
was a huge game changer.
Oh, yeah, that changed the game of computing. And we must be on the brink of another mouse, like another, or bigger, probably.
Yeah, I haven't tried the thing either, but in some of the videos, what is it? Casey Neistat one was pretty interesting because towards the end, you see a moment where he freaks out a little bit and kind of says, like, I forgot I was wearing it, I had it on for multiple hours. It was just the new reality. I just had all this information at my fingertips. And you can kind of catch a glimpse of, like you're saying, that's what computing is going to be. It's going to be integrated. We're going to have something, a smaller version of that on our head all the time.
And just to clarify for people, the reason why you're saying that Casey could say that he forgot that he was wearing it is because it wasn't in virtual reality mode. It would have been in augmented reality mode.
So he's walking around, skateboarding and buying donuts and it's, you know...
So it's just like a pair of glasses. You're looking at the world and it's superimposing.
It's using cameras to capture the world and then feeding it back to you on screens. Yeah. But in higher
but that's the trick of it. It feels like it's apparently feels like it is like transparent glasses when it's not.
Right. So is it going to come down to how unobtrusive the hardware is? I mean, I feel like ultimately the impediment here, putting cost aside because we know that cost will come down, is just clunkiness and dorkiness, that nobody is going to get laid wearing that thing.
Give the me Scott one Galloway take. I could still get
like, you need to have a pair of Ray-Bans that do this.
I think that convenience is really the main one. I don't know that it's about, like, looking cool is part of it, but I think that humans are just such creatures of convenience that it doesn't matter how cool it looks, because you could argue that the Vision Pro, like, it looks futuristic. It's sleek. It's beautiful in its design in many ways, regardless of whether you personally think it's dorky or not. But if it's too heavy, people aren't going to want to wear it. Mm. If it runs hot, they won't want it. If the battery is inconvenient, it's not going to work. So it really comes down to convenience first, in my opinion.
I mean, the BlackBerry was convenient, but it lost out to the iPhone because the iPhone became a consumer status good, right?
Yeah.
Nobody got cool cred for owning a BlackBerry, whereas the iPhone was able to pitch itself like an Hermes handbag or something, or like, you know, a pair of Gucci shoes.
It's backed up by convenient, good design.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's going to, at some point, we're going to get a way of interacting with our, I don't want to say documents because that sounds so banal, but like the world of computers. Mm. That is both cool and also super convenient. But do you have a sense of what that will be? Because I'm not sure if this is it.
I think it'll be glasses and rings.
Glasses and rings.
Yeah.
What was that?
Why rings?
Rings.
Rings?
Rings. To get finger movement. Or gloves, but I think rings will be like...
But can't they just do it with cameras now?
They can do it with cameras, but I think there will be a desire or market to be able to, like, for example, have your hands down and still be typing.
Oh, micro movements.
Yeah,
or so you're not like doing this in people's faces. Yeah.
And while you can apparently with the Vision Pro have your hands quite low, I think people naturally are going to try and Minority Report swipe the screen.
Yeah.
So I think having a little bit more tactile feedback of your hands can be down is going to, you know, influence.
Yeah.
And also potentially even then mean that you can use like an invisible mouse, essentially. Have your hand somewhere and like be...
Or just use the tip of your forefinger as a mouse, right?
Yeah.
On anything.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Or your eyes, yeah.
I also like your idea, Joel, of having like something that you can just whisper to that is
carelessly
a bone, you know, conducting microphone.
Well, maybe it'll
microphone.
Have EEG. It'll have some brain interface things on one of
it's
the straps,
cooler,
right?
Though, to just be so like, search naughty teenager.
ASMR version. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, then the person next to you on the subway is like, what did you say? You're nothing.
Nothing.
No.
Just talking in my headset.
I'm really split on this device. I can't, like, part of me loves it. I'd love to get one. I'm dying to get one. And the other part of me is like watching this trend of, you know, the idea when I got my first iPhone, I was living in the US. It was like, fantastic. I can email on the plane and then it will send when I land, or like all this. And then you see this, you know, our attention just changing over time and people working more and getting stressed more and getting overstimulated, and all the information, you know, is now in our pocket all day, every day, and next to our bed and just at our eyeballs. And now you wear this thing or a smaller version all day, and the information is going to, you know, you don't need to reach for a phone now. It's just going to be there in our eyes all day, every day. And again, it's going to have the same addiction, the same mental health challenges that come along with a phone are going to be there, and they're going to be, you know, more addictive, easier to access. And I don't know how that's going to play out when this thing goes on to scale, kind of thing. So there's something about our attention, what it's going to do to us, that I don't think that Apple will not talk about, because it's a dark kind of thing.
Well, I mean, if any tech company talks about it, Apple might. Facebook won't. Google won't.
Yeah.
Right. That's so interesting, because one of the reasons why Australia's national airline, Qantas, has dragged its feet on introducing Wi-Fi on long-haul international flights is they say that Aussies are different culturally from other nationalities and don't want it. That we like the fact that you get on a plane for 14 hours.
That's news to me.
That's news to me.
You have to look at, well, maybe we just like the excuse of being able to tell our boss that we weren't contactable. But, you know, you get on a plane, you know, that has Wi-Fi now, and everybody's working their little tits off. But you get to, you know, there was something, I feel old, for reminiscing about a time when you got on a plane and there was nothing to do and you just had to sort of look out the window or watch the movie on the overhead screen or read a book. You know, those moments are nice. I remember I was also living in New York when Wi-Fi was introduced, or rather 3G boosting was introduced on the subway. And I used to commute on the subway, and it was an incredible experience to just sit there and look at the life of New York, and people would all sit around and you occasionally make eye contact with someone, and some people would be reading and some people would be daydreaming. And then I remember when the subway got mobile phone reception and it all changed.
Yeah.
Everyone was just staring at their hands.
We don't mind wonder anymore. We barely mind wonder as a nation or as a species.
As a people.
Right. Yeah. And we don't really know what the effect that's going to be long term. I don't think it's going to be good. I think that mind wandering is a light version of sleeping, and that it does do interesting things to our brain, healthy things to our mind. It lets out, you know, it sorts things out in interesting ways. And if you take that away, it's going to be doing something like sleeping less. And we haven't really researched that well at all.
The only form of mobile phone use that I condone is podcast listening, which people should do all the time. And you can subscribe, Substack,
YouTube,
comfortableconversations.substack.com.
Or reading. I hear there's this new book called The Intuition Toolkit.
You know, Joel's new book is fabulous. The Intuition Toolkit.
I hadn't mentioned that.
What's the subtitle?
I was getting withdrawal symptoms.
The New Science of Knowing What Without Knowing Why. And if you haven't heard this week's episode of the flagship Uncomfortable Conversations podcast, the main show, which is, you know, a one-on-one interview between me and someone fascinating, Joel is our guest this week. We recorded it a few months ago. So Brian Johnson is a name that I can't believe I didn't know until Joel flagged it for me as someone to talk about. He's been doing the rounds promoting his life strategy of living according to an algorithm. Is this the way to live? Joel, who is he, and what is living according to an algorithm?
Fascinating on so many levels, right? Because I have to be careful, because I get hooked into the whole longevity thing and try and hack my life, and then it gets a bit addictive and ends up being, you know, negative mental health wise. So he started up, what was it, Braintree, I think the company was called, and sold it for something like $800 million. That was quite a while ago now. And
since what is then, that? Is that one of those learning online?
No, I think it was accounting. Do you remember? Was it accounting? Something. Yeah.
I think it's 340 million.
It was,
but I'm bad.
I thought it was like 800. No, it was close to a billion.
The self-confessed math ignoramus.
Know me.
And he's been doing interesting things. I think I ran into him at MIT at an event one time, and he was putting money into certain interesting startups. And he has a brain EG MEG company where they're building brain devices, which I've sort of followed that a bit. And then all of a sudden, he started getting into this longevity space, and he started sinking, you know, I think he spends over $2 million a year on his own personal things, right? And
$2 million a year
of his own money on his own supplements, and he does weekly blood tests.
Kurzweil levels of pill popping.
Ridiculous.
Like 200 pills. 11 pills a day.
There you go.
Yeah. But it brings up some really interesting things to tap into, some interesting philosophies, and it's worth hearing him say it in his own words. But this idea of handing your life over to an algorithm, and if that algorithm more or less guarantees you're going to be healthier, happier, stronger, live for longer, be more spiritually happy. In every dimension of his life, he says, is better, right? And he follows this algorithm because he apparently doesn't trust his own brain.
And by algorithm, just to clarify for people, you're not talking about anything to do with computers. You're talking about a set of rules
heuristics? First, and then he's updated that now to talk about it like a democracy where they do all these measurements from his organs throughout his body, his skin, his liver, his this, his that. And the idea is the algorithm is adjusted on every week or so based on how the organs are going. So if I'll try a new supplement and this organ reacts in a better, it looks younger, some methylation clock thing, then they'll adjust the algorithm for that, right? So he has to do exercise every morning, has to go to bed at 8:30, has got to do this, this, and this, stops eating at 11 a.m. and a whole lot of other things, right? Gets the perfect sleep score on all these wearables. I just find that, and he not only to say this is, you know, he says this is the future for everyone and it's inevitable, right? And I think that's interesting.
What exactly is
that
inevitable?
We will all
that
hand
everyone's
over.
Going to be that pathological about?
Yeah, he says we're all going to be at some stage following an algorithm. We can't trust our own brains to go whatever late night snacking or whatever we're going to do, right? And so, yeah, we're all going to be what he's doing. We're going to be him at some point in the future. And it's inevitable, which is a pretty strong and controversial statement, right? And people freak out at this.
Well, I interpret his messaging a little bit differently because I think he almost says those things as a bit of a hook to kind of draw people in. But when you listen to him talk more at length, he more is talking about like being an example and almost an experiment to show people possibility, right? Like you said, he talks about this idea of everyone being on board. And in an almost anarchistic way, he talks about everyone sort of needing to be working towards a common goal, which is don't die, and having this harmony between all intelligence in the world, that being humans and artificial intelligence. And it's the idea that we could achieve this. It's possible. But he doesn't really, in my opinion, step into a more, I guess, future-telling or prescriptive world of, I think this is going to happen for everyone, or we all need to do this. It's more, this is
His interviews, he says, it's inevitable for all of us. Like
I'm still unclear
whether he really believes that, or he's just trying to get, trying to get a reaction from people.
I'm still unclear about how much of this is qualitative versus quantitative. Like if his claim is that it's inevitable that people are going to surmount the biases and inadequacies of their own brains by outsourcing a lot of decision-making to rules of thumb, and that's the way that we'll structure our lives in the future, that might be true.
And we already do that,
in the sense we already,
right?
I mean, like I already do that. If I need to lose a bit of weight, then I just
cross the street. Or there's all these things, these habits we have.
Or brush your teeth every day. If I want to lose a bit of weight, then I just don't eat before noon. That's easier than making a decision every single time about what I'm going to have for breakfast. But if he's saying that it's a question of us all becoming as committed to the mission of life extension and of the tweaking of our physiology as he is, that would require changing people's priorities. I mean, I just don't care enough about eking out a final 5 years of...
No.
But an additional 5 years of life.
But he's also saying you feel better and you're happier. He's saying in all dimensions of life.
He is happier.
So, but would you... But
I wouldn't be happier being that anally retentive about
my thing is
health.
You would. You think you wouldn't, but you actually would if you follow up. And that's his thing. So the only way to get to that point is to try it for whatever, 6 months or something.
He also talks about looking at the world from the perspective of living in the 25th century. What are you going to look back at and go, this was good, this was bad? What were the pivotal moments of today that we will look at far into the future? And I think it's honestly so fascinating hearing him speak because he does truly have like a very different perspective that he's very, very dedicated to. And while I don't agree with everything he says, I think that it's very interesting. And the dedication that he has, you're right, is kind of next level. Like, yeah, you hear of all the things he does diligently every single day without fail, and you absolutely have to respect that. And I feel like he's just this incredible insight into what humans are capable of achieving, even if it's just about dedication, more than it maybe is actually living forever.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe I just have a bias against this particular way of... There's a cultish vibe in Silicon Valley at the moment that is very... that pats itself on the back for being galaxy-brained geniuses who are, you know, masters of the universe for life hacking everything and for tweaking everything and for measuring everything. You know, I sort of blame Tim Ferriss for kicking this off. You know, he's you know, God bless him, but he's like, it got to a stage where, you know, I heard him talking, or read a post of his about when he was starting his podcast. He like interviewed and hired a bunch of former NPR producers to analyze every single, you know, moment of his interviews and give him feedback on them. And then he like sort of life hacked his way to learn. It's like
everything is measured. Everything is hacked.
Everything is robotic. Everything is bureaucratized. Everything is systematized. And to me, that drains some of the romance and messiness out of human existence. And you lose something ineffable in the process.
Yeah. No, I think Brian Johnson, I think he's got a very particular personality. So he finds doing that fairly easy.
Exactly. That's why I think a lot of people, like he says, oh, you have to try it for 6 months. Well, okay, the only people who are going to try it for 6 months are people who are likely to find it fulfilling. People who think who are going to end up thinking it's a crock of shit aren't going to try it for 6 months. It's a self-selecting group of people. You know, to say that it's a universal rule that, you know, micromanaging your kidney function every morning is going to make everybody happier is ludicrous. People are different.
What if it was true though, Josh? Well, what if we all did it and then we're like, fuck, this is amazing.
It could be true. What grounds do we have for believing?
No, I know, but what if? And that's the catch. That's his kind of twist, right? That if you all do it, you'll realize. But everyone
has just like a fundamentalist Christian saying, like, if you just follow the I am the way, the truth, and the life. Like, follow me, and maybe you'll all go to heaven. Well, maybe, but I don't have any reason to believe you.
I also think that it really narrows down the human experience. Like, you know, you're already saying it's only the people that are going to find it fulfilling that'll do it. I think even more than that, it's kind of the shit of, like, you know, upper middle class people in Western countries, right? Like, you know, someone living in rural Mongolia isn't going to like look at this thing and be like, oh yeah, sounds lit. Like I truly do think that I'll be happier. It doesn't, it's not cross-cultural.
Oh, absolutely.
At all. So I don't even think that that's a question. There are too many people in the world for this to even be an option as something that's going to happen.
The people in Mongolia could dramatically enhance their yak herding if they were just more focused and diligent about the metrics of
yak herding. Went to bed at 8:30, stopped eating at 11.
Yeah. They measured the number of mils they were squirting of milk out of their
and the
yaks.
Like, he's also talking about all of these supplements that are entirely a luxury that he even has access to. Like, people in Mongolia subsist on mostly meat and like dairy products. Like, how
don't
are they going to
have time for modafinil? And yeah. I mean, it's also interesting that the cutting edge of these supplements, it's always changing. I mean, you listen to Huberman and, you know, guys like that, and they're, you know, they're saying, oh, actually, well, 18 months ago we talked about this incredible thing, but, you know, now it turns out that it actually kills you. It was like that with this diabetes drug. I bought a whole bunch of it in Thailand thinking that I was, it was just so obvious that it was good for you. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, but it actually bluntens the effects of exercise and a whole lot of things. Yeah,
it turns out not luckily to be great. I never took it because I just thought, what am I doing? But it was about a phase of my life where I was on a huge health kick and I lost like 20 kilos.
No, there were certain influences who were talking about a lot of
science about how this diabetes medication, which is very safe, which is taken by hundreds of millions of people every day, is a clear longevity drug because of the relationship, because of what it does to your insulin levels. Now they've just gone back on that. Yeah.
So does it do anything for you if you don't have diabetes? Is it like dangerous if you don't have diabetes?
Yeah, there is some suggestion now that it is. That's my point. But at the time they were saying like there's no harm in taking it because people who don't have diabetes who take it seem to outlive even people with diabetes. I mean, sorry, even people who don't have diabetes who don't take the
product. I can't help but experiment with all these things as well. It drives my wife crazy. I just did like the four months of the carnivore.
Oh, right.
But I added in the fruit and the honey and the eggs and cheese.
Another friend of mine is on this. Do you feel great? Did you feel great?
Because I run a bit and I do a lot of sauna. No, I found that the electrolyte wise, it just, even with the fruit, it wasn't. I couldn't.
She swears by it. She loves it.
People just love it.
Can you imagine that?
No. Right?
She eats apparently like cucumbers.
The texture, it's hard
meat,
to live
cucumbers,
texture wise with
fruit,
so little things. But, yeah.
Honey. Cheese.
That sounds so unenjoyable. I'm such an advocate of like, we are humans, we are messy, we're strange, just embrace it and live, you know, as well as you can. And like for Brian Johnson, that is absolutely analyzing every little crevice of his life. And I think it's so exciting because I do think that we're going to learn a lot through this self-imposed and chosen human trial of 100 different ways to try and extend your life. And that's cool. But just, I don't know that extending life should be the goal. I think enjoying
it's one of his goals, I think he says. But yeah, probably his main one. Yeah,
but all I think things enjoying in life should be the goal.
All things in moderation, including moderation.
I mean, one of the things that I haven't heard him talk about, and if you're listening, Brian, then is we've talked about free will, right? And agency is really important. We see lack of agency, learned helplessness is associated with a lot of negative mental health things. And handing over your liberty, your freedom to an algorithm, I think for a lot of people, even if they can manage to do it, is going to have a negative effect psychologically that, again, we haven't measured or we don't understand, right? Because we've talked, I don't think we have free will. We've talked about that before many times. That may be controversial. Yeah. There's no evidence we really do, but we feel like we do. And it feels very much like we do have free will and agency. And if you take that away from people, it's devastating.
Also, I mean, just what's the anxiety level of constantly monitoring yourself? Yeah. Maybe for him it's zero. Maybe for him it's a sense of empowerment. But for some people,
for me,
it's not.
I get it builds and builds.
Yeah, exactly.
Some people won't be able to hit the metrics that they're trying to hit, and that would just feel awful.
Yeah, that's right.
They're like, oh my God, I'm going to die.
There's also, I think there's a huge, we're missing, there's, I mean, this is a conversation for another day, but there's a massive blind spot, I think, in the way that we talk about risks in public health as well. This is one of my bugbears where, in the period after 9/11, a lot of the messaging around terrorism and be alert, not alarmed, and, you know, having red days and orange days and things like that, you know, what's the impact of that on our psychology? What other, you know, how many cancers are caused by the anxiety that is caused by that? You know, school drills as well. My kids had to stay back for a drill. They don't call it an active shooter drill because we're in Australia.
Really?
But it's an emergency drill.
What do they do?
In case something bad happens.
They get under the desks.
They get under their desks.
Oh, really?
They learn how to maybe, you know, be corralled, where to go in case of an emergency.
It's like a nuclear war thing or something.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what it's about. Like,
for us, it was when there was a random dog that wandered onto school.
So it could be that. I mean, it could be a bushfire. It could be a war. I don't know what they're thinking it could be, but I guess it's in case there's... So, you know, what's the impact on the psychology of kids to feel like this is an ever-present threat? Yeah, there's an ad campaign at the moment that the Australian government has put out against skin cancer, and it's really quite grisly. And it says, like, if you knew that every time you leave the house, you could die. You know, you could be sowing the seeds of cancer. And it shows a guy walking outside, and then it zooms in on his forehead, and you go inside the skin and you see a black cancerous cell start to spread, and these tendrils of like evil start to, you know, go into his head and his brain. And I'm like,
jeez,
we all know
already
about melanomas. Like, we are Australians. I get it. Yeah. Like, do I have to worry about this? Like, what's the impact on me of like having that additional layer of concern that I'm going to get a melanoma?
Just don't leave your house, Josh. Just lock the doors.
I know. So anyway, yes.
Draw the curtains.
Quit with the, I don't know, I don't want the algorithms to be contributing to that.
It's the beautiful double-edged sword of tech and science, I think, that we continue to be able to look deeper into things and learn more, thus both do better with it and have our anxieties grow. And I think, you know, we can even see this in the way that reproductive kind of health and conversations have changed since people started to be able to look in and see, oh, that's what a fetus looks like. That's, you know, we can see the cells as they grow. it starts to change how you conceptualize.
You're comparing embryos to cancers, basically, is what you're saying here.
Essentially,
no, Christian Wright is going
to
love
this. I'm saying
this.
That as we are able to see more, our perceptions of things change. And I think that it both helps in that we can, you know, treat cancer more effectively and hinders in that it brings that anxiety.
Last thing I want to pick your brains about that was in the news recently, there was a shark attack in Sydney, and there was also Australia's biggest ever lottery. Now, Joel, you were making the analogy between these two things because one is bad and one is good, but they both they both prey upon our misunderstanding of probabilities. Why?
Yeah, so I put the radio on, the TV on, and days leading up to this, I watched a lot of news, which I don't normally watch. I try to avoid the news. And so I feel anxious and depressed from watching the news. So
you're welcome.
Thanks, Josh.
Your appearance on this podcast.
Anyway, people were just like, I'm not swimming in the harbor ever again. And I'm not going to put my toe in and all this kind of talk, right? Even though the stats, the probability of a shark attack in the harbor during summer, it's really rare, right? It's safer than getting in your car. What was one thing I saw? You're more likely to be injured by a kangaroo than a shark. So you can, but people don't like.
Is that true? That's the most Australian statistic.
I didn't follow it up.
Our American listeners will be like, yeah, but what about the snakes, kangaroos, and the crocodiles?
No, it's the kangaroos because people think they can pet them.
Right, and then they get punched in the face.
They get disemboweled.
They kick with their back.
Isn't that a cassowary that disembowels you?
I think it's both. Kangaroos can with their kick, but yeah, they
can they?
You've seen
sharp nails.
You got to box them and stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so people get this, and it happens to me, right? I go for a swim, and I'm old enough to remember the Jaws music and Spielberg, and I start thinking the sharks that swim underneath me. I got to look down. Where is it? And you start freaking out. The limbic system, the emotional parts of your brain become active because you're imagining things, and you become really scared. Doesn't matter what the probabilities are, what numbers someone shows you. You start emotionally thinking, right?
It doesn't even matter if the probability is zero once you get the worm in your brain. Swimming off a Greek island in very clear water, and I was swimming quite far out into a series of like rock caves by myself. And for some reason, the idea of a shark popped into my head. It's the Mediterranean. There are no man-eating sharks in the Med. But like just the fact that
pour blood
I was
in the water there
all
and
alone
happened,
and like the water was deep and I could see a long way, I just started getting the heebie-jeebies. But it's like a bit like, you know, starting to be afraid of a ghost or an alien when you're in bed and everything's dark. It's a monster reflex, isn't it? Regardless of probability.
And then the lotteries, right? We had this big lottery last week, 200 million, I think it was. And it's a similar thing, right? Everyone ignores the probabilities of winning and more people buy it. And the probability of winning goes down as more people buy it. But everyone just imagines, but you got to be in it to win it. And so everyone imagines the change of life and all this. Even though the data on winning lottery is actually mixed, a lot of people regret it a year later, and there's some interesting things with happiness there. But anyway, so both these examples of that we don't do well with probabilities, particularly low probability things.
Mm.
And low probability, L, is actually going back to, did I mention I have a book that just came out? I may not have mentioned it to you yet. Anyway, it's an acronym there called SMILE, and the L in that is for low probability, and sometimes call that the shark attack rule, because don't use your intuition for these kind of things, right? Don't try and feel your way around lotteries or winning or shark attacks because the emotions take over. We just don't get probabilities.
Plane crashes,
yeah. Right? We get emotional thinking. We start getting scared. So that's one of the rules around intuition. We should just stay away from that. I just think it's interesting when these things take over and they spread almost like a virus horizontally through the nation.
Are you vulnerable to this stuff, Rad, or are you like a hyper-rationalist?
I am a deeply anxious person.
Really?
A gift from my mother.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mom. No, she is someone who is very, very good at predicting outcomes and very, very motivated to avoid bad outcomes, right? And I think that that's in a lot of ways very natural. And I think you're right. It requires sort of active choosing to move away from that and go, I know that the probability is low and therefore I'm not going to make this decision. So one example is I have a very beautiful dog that I love very much. And my mom is terrified of me tying him up outside a shop or something to go inside the shop because she's like, what if something happens to him? What if someone steals him? When I was a kid and there was that really, really awful story about, I think, a 3 or 4-year-old boy who was taken by 2 8-year-old boys in the middle of a crowded area and killed, she really freaked out. And she was like, what if that would have happened to you? And, you know, you can start to take in all of those stories and go, the worst case scenario is so bad that I am unwilling to even roll those dice.
Mm.
And that is something that has, in a lot of ways, been instilled on me. I try to move away from it and I go, look, Australia is a country where there is a culture of tying dogs up outside. I generally am only ever gone 10, 15 minutes. I don't tie them up anywhere hot. I don't tie them up near the road. I take all of these precautions, but it still sits inside you, this fear of the what if. And I think on the flip side, you have the hope of the what if with the lottery example. And baby, I think that's just being human.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong, is there, with using the algorithm, to go back to that, of I don't want to tolerate any risk of X, therefore I'm not going to do Y. You just have to be consistent about the application of that refusal. So, like, I don't think it's irrational necessarily.
But you want to rank, right? So you don't want to go around being worried about it being hit by lightning, or like things that are very low, right?
You want to rank them, so cardiac events
at the top of the list, to finish that point.
To actually be consistent would derange your life. So take the example of a plane crash. Like, I don't think it's inherently unreasonable to say, I want the risk of dying in a plane crash to be zero, therefore I'm not going to fly. But you would also have to say, therefore I'm not going to drive. Like, it's so much, there are so many other riskier things that in order to be consistent, you would also have to say, I'm not going to take all of these other risks.
But why do you have to be consistent?
Well, that's a good point. Maybe you don't. Maybe it's okay to be like, I don't want any risk of dying in a plane crash. What's wrong with that, Joel?
Well, I think the point more is around, right, there's a cost to whatever you pay attention to as an individual or as a nation, right? And if we pay attention to all the things that feel scary, the sharks, the snakes, the Teslas taking control and smashing, you know, the cars going crazy, whatever the thing is that is most emotional, then we're ignoring the things that actually cost lives. So there's a cost to that. So we, whether an individual or as a nation or as a politician, you have to choose where the resources go.
Mm.
And you want to match that, not 100%, but more or less with the things that are most dangerous, right? So what's the Jerry Seinfeld thing that people are more afraid of public speaking than dying? So they'd rather be in the casket than give the eulogy, right? And so it's funny, but it's kind of true as well, right? So as a nation and as individuals, the things that are most dangerous, we should put our resources towards and avoid or apply an algorithm to those. And the things that are really maybe very scary and keep us up at night, but actually aren't very dangerous, we've got to find ways of psychologically dealing with those.
I guess it depends whether or not we're just talking about, do I not want to die, or is there a particular scenario that I'm trying to avoid? Like, I'm quite good at making my rational brain override my lizard brain. So I can understand how awful it must be to not have that ability, because I spent the first half of my life judging people who don't have that ability for not having it and thinking that they should just get their shit together.
Low blood sugar, but that will change, right? When you're low, but you haven't eaten for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. There are times when it's easier and times when it's not.
It's going to get harder.
You know, if I'm on a plane and I freak out because I wake up and there's horrendous turbulence or something, I just, you know, force my rational brain to go, you know, this is vanishingly unlikely. Stop being so. Yeah. Stop having so much hubris that you think that you're going to be in a plane crash. It's like,
have you ever had like an anxiety attack or anything? Like
yeah,
that?
I have. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've had it a couple of times. A couple of the worst experiences of my life. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So you've had that experience of body takes over.
Yeah, total out of controlness. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that for some people, that is like the experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awful.
Looking at any of these probabilities, that's, you think about the what could happen and it's unbearable.
Mm.
There is no rational brain that can come online. And that's a whole different conversation about...
Yeah, mental health and the way our brains work and everything. Yeah. Well, you've enhanced my mental health through this conversation. Thank you, Joel. Thank you, Rad. Lovely to have you on the show.
Good fun.